I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast. We are live for the second time at the National Security Girls Squad, the NatSec Girls Squad Conference in Washington. It is December 12th, 2019, and I am here with Danielle Citrin, who has an enormous number of great distinctions, but since things are all about me, the first one of them is that she's the only person who's ever managed to get me to write a law review article. She is also, more importantly, a professor of law at Boston University, one of the truly great deep thinkers on technology, sexual privacy, online content moderation, harassment, and the future ways that all these things are coming together in fashions that are quite ugly. And yes, as of the other day, she is a MacArthur grantee. The thing we are not allowed to call a MacArthur Genius Award, she's actually got one. So, Danielle, welcome to NatSec Girl Squad and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast.
It's even more fun than I thought to see you say the intro than just only hearing it. I can't describe that excitement, but it was really fun. No, it's wonderful to be here.
It takes so little to please. I want to start with how we met, because I think it actually brings together the theme that we're here to talk about. I was thinking about the problem of remote attacks, and I was thinking it started in the context of drone strikes, and I got interested in this question of sexual extortion online, which was this other area that I could identify where people were attacking each other transcontinentally. And we'll talk about the substance of that issue a little bit later on. But one of the things that I noticed was that the entirety of the literature on remote attacks was taking place not in the cybersecurity context, or at least this type of remote attack, not in the context of the national security discussion, but in the context of feminist law professors and activists writing about things like non-consensual pornography. And so I ended up asking Danielle to review the work that we had done at Brookings on this, and that's kind of how we came together. And I'm interested for your thoughts on, we think of these Venn diagrams as very far apart, the national security arena and the kind of sexual privacy, online abuse arenas. And then you think about what we're talking about on a day-to-day basis and its relationship to things like Gamergate, its relationship to things that you guys have been writing about for a long time. And so I am just interested in the highest level of altitude in your thoughts on what did the national security community miss that the feminist law community has been onto for the last, I don't know, 15 or 20 years or so.
Yep. So one will seem slightly critical, and the other I'm going to start with, which is less critical of the national security field and just society writ large, which is women are kind of the canaries in the coal mine when it comes to ways in which we can use, or, you know, newly developing digital technologies to torment, to deprive people of all of their key life opportunities. The sort of first victims to this, you know, who perpetrators often will start experimenting with these tools, is women and marginalized people. And especially women who are women of color, trans women, you know, if you're gay, you're gonna face this sort of thing first. So when I first started working, this was about 12 or 13 years ago, on cyber mobs, and the targeting of individuals with privacy invasions, so nude photos without consent, rape and death threats, defamation, accusing someone of either being a prostitute or available for sex. You know, the cyber mobs often would attack women and people from vulnerable communities. And what's interesting, so it's just, Ben and I were just at a discussion about disinformation at Harvard Law School, and a friend of ours is one of the chief policy people for Facebook on cybersecurity, and he said Facebook now calls cyber mobs, they're like cyber brigades. And Nathaniel was someone who was kind of with me in the trenches 12 years ago when I first started writing about cyber mobs. And he said, yeah, we have a name for it. It's still the same damn cyber mobs. So, you know, the way in which we're seeing network tools used to force people offline, to discredit them, to torment them, to invade their sexual privacy or privacy, generally speaking, to defame, often the first victims are the most vulnerable. And we use what's vulnerable about them, right, their sexuality, their sexual identity, in ways that are, of course, sexually demeaning and sexually threatening. And so what, so this was my, that's my not judgmental story. What's slightly judgmental is, so why is it that the national security, until Ben started shaking it with Quinten Matt, right, in thinking about sextortion, you know, why is it that the national security community like wasn't wise to all of this? And in a part, it's because of societal values, right, which trivialize gendered harms. We just don't take them seriously. And so now, and working with Facebook and Twitter for, I would say, about 10 years, you know, we've seen lots of progress in ways they think about these issues, and they're often sort of dubbed safety issues, right, when they're really kind of security for us all writ large, which, you know, in your work on sextortion was evidently clear, like a much broader lens. It wasn't just women and vulnerable people. It was all sorts of people. And we could use sextortion to steal national secrets. Like, there are ways in which these modes of attack, the early victims are the often the most vulnerable individuals who we don't often see and recognize the harm. And now, 12 years later, 13 years later, we're starting, I think, to see it for the fullness of the problem that it is.
All right, so there's a huge amount in there, and I want to kind of unpack a number of discrete different pieces of it. So I'm gonna throw this out as a provocation with limited idea of whether it's God's truth or total bullshit, but let's see what we can do with it. What the Russians did to the DNC and to the Democratic campaign in 2016 is essentially exactly what you were writing about in sexual privacy, only not a state against a political party, but a bunch of misogynists against women.
Yep.
Right? It's exactly the same thing. It's dox. It's stealing material. It's doxing in the context of belittling comments in a fashion that makes it very difficult to be part of the public discussion.
It's discrediting, right? So all of the vectors of attack are indeed the same, right? The stealing of emails, to post them out online, to shame, embarrass, take them out of context, which is often the key, right? To be misleading often. It's not that the personal information is so damning. It's out of context. It seems incredibly damning, right? And so it is, was indeed the vectors that we saw 12 years ago or 15 years ago with cyber mobs on early bulletin boards are, it's the same playbook. It's now being used to, you know, to forward state agendas, right, and malicious state actors. And we often don't think of them the same, but the tools in the toolbox of the abuse of abusive behavior is the same.
And so I'm interested here in the critique of the national security community. Should people have been looking at Gamergate and saying, gosh, if I were a foreign actor that wanted to wreak havoc on the US political system, I would do this. This is happening somewhat organically, but we can engineer this. Should people have anticipated, based on what was happening in your world, what was going to happen in the broader political and national security world? Or is this an example of that's really easy to see in retrospect, but it was actually required a certain innovation on the part of the Russians, and there wasn't a particular sign from the worlds in which you were operating that was the direction it was going. It was just a problem that was affecting lots of women and you know, people in online spaces from marginalized communities.
So I think if we were really paying attention that the answer is we should have seen it coming, in part because the propaganda story is one of discrediting, marginalizing, casing someone as the wrongdoer, right? We've seen this playbook. So in many respects, what Gamergate might, the folks who went after Brianna Wu and Zoe Quinn and others who doxed them, so published their home addresses online and said that they deserved to die and to be, right, to be raped, who posted discrediting things about them, suggesting they were prostitutes. You name the lie, it's included, but it was often demeaning. And so threats, privacy invasions, the doxing, swatting, sending people, calling the police and sending them to their homes on the notion that there is sort of a live shooter inside, which is life-threatening. So in many respects, that is borrowing from the propaganda playbook that isn't new. It was an effective tool for the Gamergate community. And now the folks, what's interesting is, 2014, the summer of 2014 is when we saw the sort of fever pitch of Gamergate. But of course, a lot of that started sort of long before with Anita Sarkeesian, who makes videos about sexism in video games. When we started paying attention to Gamergate, surely, everyone's taking notes on each other's effective campaigns of, the effective ways in which we can silence people, chase them up on, and discredit them. So surely it's like a give and take. But I would think we should have been paying attention in the national security space.
I want to come to sextortion, which is an area that seems to me both communities missed, right? So
I think that's an important part of the story too, Ben, that I too, like bringing the fact that even folks working on cyberstalking
didn't notice sextortion.
And for reasons that I can explain, but I think that's really important.
Let's talk about that, because I think this is one of those weird areas that the security community missed for one set of reasons, and the online abuse and safety and inclusion communities missed for a completely different set of reasons. So let's talk about, how is it that a group of people that were concerned about cyberstalking, who were concerned about non-consensual pornography, more colloquially called revenge porn, who were concerned about doxing and these kinds of online abuse, missed an epidemic of sextortion, which you would think is sufficiently conceptually related that the same concerns that would lead you to be worried about one would lead you to worry about the other, and yet was really not part of the discussion in a serious way.
In part, some of that reason is for the sheer fact that sextortion thrives in secrecy. Right. The whole idea of sextortion is that, perpetrator says to victim, give me more nude photos and perform a sex act on webcam. And if you tell anyone, I post this online. And how it thrives is in silence. Why we were missing it, for the most part, this truly epidemic, it's amazing how many perpetrators would have hundreds of victims that you helped show in your two important reports on sextortion, was that people were being victimized, and they were listening to their perpetrators, and they weren't telling anyone. And law enforcement, in an effort to address some of these issues slowly, right, slowly but surely, you documented some of these cases, but they really, they stayed hidden in some sense because your victims wanted them hidden. It's a privacy violation to even talk about it, associating their names with it. Of course, victims weren't named, but so in some sense, it's not that, so in my book, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, I interviewed victims of non-consensual intimate imagery whose exes at first threatened that if they didn't allow the victims to have these pictures taken of them or taken of themselves, that they would do X, something abusive. But it wasn't necessarily that they would post nude photos. And so we did see some uses of intimate imagery or the threat of it or in its disclosure predicated on threats. But it wasn't clear that it was in itself part of the story of what I call invasions of sexual privacy.
Yep.
for that reason, because it was they were effective, the perpetrators.
Yeah, I mean, it's this weird area that merges this the areas that you've written about with more conventional child exploitation and just kind of garden variety extortion, right? It's a weird thing that way. There is also the sense in which law enforcement did not miss it. I mean, this we know about these matters because a bunch of people in law enforcement pursued a bunch of these cases, and that's. But as the community that I think has a lot of responsibility for missing this is the cybersecurity community, and I want to talk about the vocabulary of this because it bothers me a lot. You know, cybersecurity is about protecting online the things that we value, right? So if I compromise a bank and take the things that it values, i.e. money or its records, we call that cybersecurity, right? And if I steal government secrets, we call that cybersecurity to the extent that I do it by any electronic means. But if I take what a 15-year-old boy or girl has of value, which is to say images of themselves, and we don't call that cybersecurity. We call it online safety. We come up with some other name for it. We call it, you know, being safe online, right? We call it, you know, don't talk to strangers, right? We have these kind of other vocabularies. And so my question is, are we in a unrealistic and distortive fashion gendering cybersecurity in a fashion that is privileging the cybersecurity concerns of entities that are more rather than less powerful, and in this context anyway, more rather than less male?
So yes, in calling, broadly speaking, matters of national security that involve, you know, network tools, when calling it cybersecurity calls it out as a societal harm. It's structural. And how we often trivialize harm is to individuate it, right? For harassment, to call it just a one-off, or it's online safety or abuse, is to miss the broader structural story that is actually happening. And that's why in my work, I've called the problem of online abuse one of the cyber civil rights, that it is fundamentally structural and it's interfering with people's life opportunities. That is, groups of vulnerable people. It is a societal problem, right? Much in the way that we once said of sexual harassment in the workplace, it's no big deal, just boys being boys, just get over it. It's an individual problem. You know, he's got a crush on you, calm yourself, which is often what people were told in the late 60s, early 70s. We, over time, began to see it as a real social problem, a problem for all of us, a problem for employers, employees, and healthy and productive workplaces. And we've had to have, unfortunately, the same kinds of education of all, each and every one of us, to see online abuse not just as a one-off, not just a no big deal, boys will be boys, though law enforcement still says that to victims, and it's frustrating, though at Cyber Civil Rights, Mary Ann Franks and I are working on that. But nonetheless, that's the way to trivialize the problem, is to individuate it, and then so you can just then, you say it's no big thing. If we fail in this case, so the world won't fall. But the truth of the matter, if we understand it as structural, as fundamentally a cybersecurity problem, right? A problem for all of us, as well as, I think, a civil rights problem, then we're gonna take it much more seriously. Then we're gonna appreciate the harm. And in a way, that's why, you know, having worked on non-consensual intimate imagery, video voyeurism, sextortion, deep fake sex videos, I've argued that we should understand them all as invasions of sexual privacy. Because once you start to see the structural harm, then we're going to have society pay much more attention to it. Then it's much harder to walk away from, right? So we're, you know, working with lawmakers on non-consensual intimate imagery on Capitol Hill, you know, we've been working on a bill for the past 3 years, and we've got bipartisan support. But I think some of the problem is we've gotten people to pay attention to the issue, but we're not seeing it in the totality of its harm. And it is just one of many invasions of sexual privacy that make it really difficult to live your best life, right? To get a job, keep a job, and so, you know, have relationships. And so I think that question is so important because it gets at your question, which gets at the structural social attitudes, that if we don't take it seriously, of course we're not going to address it.
So there's another prejudice in the cybersecurity community, which I think plays a role here, and I'm interested in your thoughts on it, which is the cybersecurity community is really interested in hard technical security problems. And sextortion is actually not a hard technical problem. There's no vulnerability in these platforms that is giving rise to it. It's about the security of people rather than the security of internet-connected devices. And I'm interested in your thoughts on whether this is a broader question than just this, but is the notion of cybersecurity too interested in the security of machines relative to the security interests of actual people?
I think I couldn't agree more, heatedly so. It's absolutely much more than the sort of rule-ish, sort of code-like problems that we can fix. Human beings are the bug in the code. There's no question about it. And so as a privacy scholar, you know, data breaches, why do we have the Podesta hack? Why? Because somebody was an idiot, right? Clicked on an email they shouldn't have clicked on. We are the weakest link, human beings, whether it's for data breaches, malware, deep fakes. We are the bug in the code. And so, yes, I think we've got to pay much more attention to the what we might call a sort of soft problems that are hard to get your arms around because it involves educating people. It involves law enforcement. It involves applying the law. It's not just technologists, right? Those are harder problems.
All right. So let's talk in the spirit of telling stories about Danielle along the way of this podcast. So one of the really fascinating things as, you know, she came to work with more and more national security people was that the number of areas where your traditional concerns turned out to be the same as big national security questions proliferated, right? And so the most extreme example of this is your and Bobby Chesney's work together on deepfakes. So Bobby Chesney is a very traditional national security scholar. And if you had told me 5 years ago that the two of you would write an article together on a subject that was entirely organic to both of your core concerns, and it would seem completely natural, I would have had a very difficult time imagining what that subject could be. And yet, here it is, like technology presented it. So talk to us about deepfakes, and with the following question in mind, are they a bigger concern for the individual woman or a bigger concern for the political system?
Okay, good. So I'm gonna answer that, I promise. But it's always fun to shout your friends out when they do that to you. So lots of all good things in life so often lead to Ben. So Ben is why, first of all, I'm so happy I got to be the one to finally convince him to write a law review article, which I have to say has been quite successful in convincing folks on the Hill.
You win on this one.
You know what I'm saying, right? I'm glad that we did that. We wrote about Section 230.
But I'm not writing another one.
Oh, well, don't say that never, right, audience? They may be able to convince you. You might consider writing just another one with me. But I met Bobby Chesney through Ben. And yes, when Bobby is indeed a national security scholar in a way, I bet he wouldn't have said he would have written with a feminist privacy scholar 5 years ago. But when the issue came up about deepfake sex videos that were appearing on Reddit, in April, I think it was 2017, Bobby and I both kind of wrote to each other and said, I think we figured out what we're going to write about together. Because by Bobby's lights, the problem was, hey, how are we going to use this in ways that's going to cause mischief, either in diplomatic relations, military operations, privacy generally, which interested both of us. And for me, where we were seeing, and again, that story of the canary in the coal mine, where we were seeing it really just on the ground, and I'm going to explain in a second why we're still seeing it, was the deep fake sex videos, where you insert women's faces into porn and then turn them into, you know, they're in pornography they never chose to be in.
And can I just, at the risk of interrupting, I just want to foot stomp the canary in the coal mine point here, because this is yet another issue where if you want to understand things that national security people are going to be thinking about or need to be thinking about right now because of what's going to happen 3, 4, 5 years from now, look at what's happening in the porn industry right now.
Absolutely.
And I think that point is deep and has, you know, cross-cutting importance in a lot of different areas. And I don't want to tell you all, go spend more time with porn, but maybe go spend more time thinking about porn.
And the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and online abuse, right?
Yeah, so, exactly.
So what is, and I think what was interesting, having worked with Ben and Quinta and Bobby before Bobby and I joined together to write a law review article and then a series of articles together, was that rather than wait 5 years to let it become a problem that we thought, yeah, this probably will be national security, we immediately both recognized that that's precisely what it was. It was a privacy, national security, free speech, democracy problem. And we were going to get at it right away. So in some sense, we didn't let it, the delay happened, that gap between sextortion, you know, the feminist legal scholars working on free speech and privacy, you know, we took us a while to even know if it was a problem, and then to embrace it fully as a problem of invasions of sexual privacy. Like, Bobby and I didn't want to wait, right? We wanted to write a series of articles about why we should care, whether you come at it from the national security perspective, privacy, free speech, or just frankly being a democratic citizen, you know, a citizen and allegedly a democracy, wants to keep it that way. We figured we had to jump on it. And what is clear, though, and your initial question, Ben, was like, how do we know it's a gendered problem? So Deep Trace Labs out of in the UK just came out with a study in September, which showed that it found that there were 15,000 deepfake videos online, either identified as deepfakes or through scraping they could figure out it was a deepfake, that were 96% of those videos were deepfake sex videos, and 99% of those videos inserted women's faces into porn without their consent. So it is just a matter of empirical fact that it is a gendered problem right now, and the concerns that Bobby and I wrote about include the deep fake released the night before an election that shows a major party candidate, let's say gravely ill, and then tips the election, or the deep fake the night before the stock IPO that shows the CEO doing and saying something he should never or she should have ever said, and therefore, you know, sort of tanks the IPO, sort of decision choke points where we're going to see implications for our faith in the market, our faith in elections and democracy, you know, sort of the Nancy Pelosi cheap fake or shallow fake, you know, more often and at really, really important decisional points that I think we have gotten people's attention. So in the summer, so in June, I testified before the House Intelligence Committee, the Permanent Select Committee, about deep fakes. And it was a hearing about national security. But I think we, at least from my perspective, it was successful in getting them to see that it was indeed a gendered problem first, and that to let them know that they should, just as we're saying now, Ben, we should be looking at spaces of online abuse that target vulnerable people as a nod to where national security problems are coming from next.
Basically, if it's happening to a 15-year-old girl in high school now, it'll be happening to the country 5 years from now.
Right. Yep. To devastating effect. Right.
All right. So we've looked at an example, couple examples, where the blinders are on in both communities or all communities, and we're not drawing connections that we should be drawing. And here we have an example where the blinders are not on. People are you know, as this technology develops, talking about the relationships between, thanks to the two of you, talking about the relationships between the national security problem and the personal security, sexual privacy problem. That suggests to me, both in a positive, negative sense, that these communities actually have a very fruitful dialogue to have with one another, and that there is, that we think of them as the Venn diagrams are very separate circles, but in fact, there's a significant space of overlap that is really, really fruitful when you spend time in it. And so my question to you is, what are the barriers to that? You know, they're very different communities. They don't live with one another. They don't talk to one another very much. And so I'm just interested in your thoughts. What would a dialogue in a sustained, serious way between the sort of feminist privacy law types and national security concerns look like, and what are the big impediments to it?
So it strikes me that this room is precisely to the answer to that question, right? The NatSec girls community is precisely the community that's going to help bridge those conversations. That so often we don't see a problem is because we don't know who's suffering from it, and it's not highlighted, it's not before our eyes. And so this community and the work at Lawfare and some of the work that, you know, we'll do together is going to be part of that and facilitating that conversation. Because I think there's no doubt in my mind that there have been some aha moments, that no longer can we say they're separated, they're not disaggregated, they're part of the same story. So I actually think we're part of an early conversation that's going to keep growing the more, unfortunately, we see some of these tactics that are used against more vulnerable people are going to be used fruitfully by state actors. So I guess, what do they say, we're ground zero in that important work of that conversation that I think will only build? And you're right, it is like, you know, I don't normally sit down with generals, right? Or God bless, love Adam Schiff, but, or Devin Nunez. But, you know, I found myself having conversations with them, right, at the committee hearing and then staffers. So hopefully we just all join that conversation and bring those stories to folks, either as policymakers, you know, in the legislature, at the executive branch, you know, through litigation in the courts. We're going to have to bring them to the table.
Let's take some audience questions. Have at it, guys.
Good afternoon. I think it's afternoon. My question is actually about an intersection of this that I think we kind of brushed past a little bit, and it's the old notion of, like, the honeypot. Right? So as more women are entering the national security field, they are going to become vulnerable to opposing state actors, threatening and discrediting them. And back in the day, they used to do this by, you know, tricking a CIA agent or whatever into a compromising situation with a person who was an agent posing as a sexy lady. But now you don't even have to be in the same room to take that picture, because all you need to do is hack the cloud. Or you have to find their ex-boyfriend who hates their guts.
And or even just a photo and make a deep fake sex video.
Yeah, or that. I mean, but the reality is that the ability to take intimate images has become so much more easy. And as more young women are entering this workforce, that becomes a vulnerability for us. And I just went to a presentation on an SF-86, and I can't imagine having to go in to my employer and say, I have taken a nude photo of myself in the past and disclosed that as a vulnerability, in the same way that once you may have been expected to disclose something else, like a financial vulnerability. Because that is a vulnerability for young women, is this image of me is out there somewhere, and maybe it's an ex-boyfriend, or maybe it's a hacker, or maybe it's just the cloud.
So first of all, you know, it is not just a vulnerability for young women, it's a vulnerability for young men as well. And in fact, there is one of the weirder corners of the world of sextortion is a kind of industrial effort to sextort military age men, and there has been actually had to be guidance on it from some of the services because enough people were being caught up in these schemes. And the scheme is pretty simple. You're a beautiful woman friends you on Facebook, and you get to chatting, and you're, you know, a 19-year-old enlisted guy, right? And she sends you a nude picture and asks for one, and you send her one, and then it turns out that the beautiful young woman is actually a call center in the Philippines that wants $10,000. And, you know, this is a pretty standard scam now, and it's catching a lot of people. So your point is exactly right, but it's all, the issue is not just a, you know, a security clearance, you know, what could be stolen from you. It's also a real-time thing. Do you have further thoughts on this, Danielle?
And I guess what I was thinking is that it's going to sort of force a conversation about kind of how we grapple with this, which on the one hand, I feel like just a conversation Ben and I have had offline about when you have the person that's being sextorted, my view is, A, of course, you never give in, and that needing to teach us about invasions of sexual privacy and its sacredness and trusting each other and confidentiality versus that inclination. I feel like we had this conversation where you sort of pull the sting and put your own nude photo up to say, you can't sextort me because I don't care. I don't want us to feel like people ever have to make, which is something we've talked about, to ever have to make that choice, because fundamentally sexual privacy is about your autonomy and dignity. And it's your choice if you want to share your nude photo. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But so long as whoever you share it with understands your expectations and respects and is discreet with those expectations, that it is, we have so much education to do about our norms and expectations and behaviors and attitudes and how we have to respect the boundaries that people draw around their intimate lives rather than saying, this is a way we can exploit you, and unless you exploit yourself, you can't deal with it.
Good afternoon. I agree completely that cybersecurity specifically is focused on protecting machines rather than people, but I think, and I'm not defending that position by any stretch, but I think we often define our problems by the solutions that we have. And so the folks in this field are trained on that sort of thing, penetration testing, everything else, and that's the solution. My imagination is limited to the tools I have to answer the problem. So I guess that's sort of a challenge, and a question is, what sort of solution areas should national security and cybersecurity people be looking to that they're not using right now?
Do you want to take that?
No, you start us off. I saw you smiling and nodding of the head.
No, I mean, I think the question reflects a very deep insight, which is that we tend to define problems, included in terms of the tools that we have to address them. It's the old, if your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And the problem with doing that in the cybersecurity arena is that the number of issues that and vulnerabilities that people have and things that they want to protect and vectors to attack them through networked enabled means is much vaster than the set of problems that arise from the technical deficiencies of those machines. And, you know, if you want to protect people from online abuse, there is a technical dimension to that, but the fundamental problem is not technical. The fundamental problem is, first of all, forensic. How do you find the people who are doing it? Secondly, it's the unwillingness of people to report these incidents. It's very similar in that respect to real world kind of meat space sexual assault, right? You have a forensic question, a proof question, and you also have a shame and unwillingness to come forward question that are in fact partly driven by the problems that happen when you do. So these are not technical problems. And my point is only, I don't think we should fail to think about it in cybersecurity terms, because it is a proliferating set of problems that actually affect people's safety and experience using machines that are connected to one another, merely because the solutions may not be engineering solutions.
Ooh, it's my turn. Woo-hoo. So I get to have the last question. And I have a few of them, and I will only pick one. And certainly to echo all of the points you all have made, I mean, we're already seeing the impacts of this, right? Katie Hill just resigned from being a member of Congress. And there are so many conversations to be had about the behavior of men in positions of power and their staying power nonetheless. And you're both certainly right. I mean, I adore both of you. You know that. This is a gendered problem. The way we talk about it is a gendered problem. And the fact that this is a personal responsibility thing blows my mind. I'm curious about how should our institutions respond to do the right thing, right? So a couple of weeks ago, we saw the United States Marine Corps stand up and, shockingly, do the right thing. An enlisted Marine, I believe she's a reservist, found herself in a position where some images she took consensually and shared consensually were shared without her consent. Her name was shared in a way that she did not know would be, et cetera, et cetera. And the leadership of the Marine Corps stood up and said, "We stand by our Marine." And they deserve many, many gold stars for that. What should we be doing when something like this happens? Because let's face it, it's 2019, and more people than not have either actual compromising photographs or the ability to have them made. So pretending they don't exist isn't going to work.
The notion that our employers stand behind us is a huge one. And what's so depressing with Katie Hill is that, you know, it took months and months and months. Of course, Al Franken resigned. But no question that if Katie Hill was, you know, Ken Hill, that we wouldn't have seen a resignation as quickly as we did. And there's no question in my mind either that some of that, the sort of scurrilous attacks on her, that she was sleeping with a current staffer were, frankly, it seemed to be completely untrue. And we just read her op-ed, sort of a searing op-ed about her thoughts of suicide, that she thought her life was over. That I want us, I mean, we are seeing, so it is really gratifying, of course, to hear about in the case of the Marines, you know, we had Marines United, that Facebook group where men were posting the nude photos of their colleagues, and we ignored it for a while, and it's true, folks got on top, you know, at some point, the institution got ahead of it and addressed the problem. But the more that we see people in power and privilege standing up for individuals who are vulnerable, that's when we know we're in a much better place in terms of our social attitudes. Law can, you know, law is our teacher. It can provide some of those lessons, but so much of it is how we all behave and how we change our behavior, so that when employers and folks in power start standing up for people who've been targeted and say, "We're not going to let this count against your job. We're not going to not hire you because there's a nude photo in a Google search of your name," that's when we know we've sort of won.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you all for joining us, and please join me in thanking Danielle for joining us.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet done so, please take a second to share the Lawfare podcast on social media, rate us wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. And you know you want to, because our swag is kind of awesome. Our podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is, as always, performed by the one, the only, the Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.